Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident that's ultimately going into radiology. And this is episode 110 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I will be continuing my review for the American Board of Internal Medicine exam and the medicine entering exam slash step three. And in this episode, we'll be continuing our discussion of rheumatology. So let's just jump right into it, right? So what if you get a question about like a 25-year-old guy comes in with like low back pain, tells you the doc, I feel stiff in the morning. I can't like extend my back much. But as I sort of work out, if I work out for like 2 hours, I sort of feel a lot better. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're potentially thinking about like ankylosing spondylitis, right? So I'm just basically using this vignette to begin our discussion of the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? So, what are some key things about the seronegative spondyloarthropathies you want to keep at the back of your mind for these exams? The first thing is you want to keep in mind that these things mainly affect the spine, right? So they affect your axial skeleton for the most part. And one thing that is almost like a pathognomonic hallmark of these diseases, and again, I'll talk about them in a bit, is enthesitis, right? Enthesitis is just a boss phrase to mean inflammation of a region where ligament or tendon meets bone. Okay, so for example, right, if you look at your Achilles, right, like ligaments and tendons are meeting bone at that point, or at your elbow, right? So those are common areas of inflammation in these seronegative spondyloarthropathies, and also in the spine as well, right? In fact, I'll say mainly in the spine. And I mean, for the most part, these things are all a rheumatoid factor negative. Right, and then you want to remember for sure that these are all associated with like HLA-B27, right? Although having a positive HLA-B27 does not mean you have a seronegative spondyloarthropathy, right? I mean, like HLA-B27 is found in almost like 10% of the world's population, right? So you kind of want to be careful with that. In fact, this is a very nice way for them to integrate biostats with this, right? So having a positive HLA-B27 is kind of sensitive for the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? But it's not specific, okay? So that's something to keep in mind. And the thing is, what are the four diseases that fall under this? There's actually more than four, but the four you need to know for your exams, right? So there's the psoriatic arthritis, right? The mnemonic, you probably remember from step one, is the mnemonic pair, right? So the P is for psoriatic arthritis, the A is for ankylosing spondylitis. The I is for like IBD associated enteropathy, right? And then the R is for like the reactive arthritis. Yeah, it was previously known as Reiter syndrome, but people don't use that term anymore. So, what's the way these things classically present? I just gave you that, right? So, you're gonna be a young person, they complain of low back pain, it's worse in the morning, better during the day, especially when they work out. And these people, right, they may classically have like eye problems as well, right? In fact, many patients with the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, they tend to get a uveitis, okay? So getting a slit lamp exam may be the correct next best step, or as in a question you see on one of these tests. So, and I mean, they have like some classic findings on imaging, especially like ankylosing spondylitis. They tend to have like bilateral sacroiliitis, right? So they tend to affect both of the sacroiliac joints, but I'll give you some exceptions to that. And then in addition, these people, especially like ankspond, again, they tend to have like the bamboo spine, like the fused spine, right? So, what are the big things we want to know about these, right? Let me say some generalities. The thing I'll just tell you is there are many similarities between the IBD associated enteropathy and sorry, I mean IBD associated arthritis and ankylosing spondylitis. So I'll kind of recommend learning both together. These two conditions, they tend to have like the symmetric like spine involvement or like symmetric like sacroiliac joint involvement, right? And the thing is, many patients that actually have ankylosing spondylitis, kind of like IBD, right? They tend to have inflammation of their gut as well. And the thing is, these people that have these two arthritides, they usually do not have peripheral joint involvement. They can, but it's rare, okay? Contrast this with the pair of like the psoriatic arthritis and the reactive arthritis. These people tend to have lots of peripheral joints involved in addition to the axial joint involvement. And then another thing is, instead of having like the symmetric sacroiliac joint involvement that you see in Angspond and IBD-associated arthritis, these people tend to have like asymmetric involvement of the sacroiliac joint. So that's one thing you kind of want to think, keep at the back of your mind on these exams. So if we sort of talk about them one by one, right? So I mean, kind of start with ankylosing spondylitis. Again, I've sort of given you the classic presentation: young man, low back pain, worse in the morning, better with working out. They have the enthesitis, right? So those classic things that I've already mentioned. But there are some high yield things you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind that are testable on these exams with regards to ankylosing spondylitis, right? So the thing is, remember when I've always talked about atlantoaxial instability with rheumatoid arthritis and juvenile idiopathic arthritis and Down syndrome, right? These people that have ankylosing spondylitis, again, before you send them for surgery or anything that will involve extensive neck manipulation, you want to make sure that you get an X-ray of the cervical spine with views in flexion and extension, right, to rule out atlantoaxial instability so you don't get burned. And one other weird thing they love to test on exams with regards to ankylosing spondylitis is that these people, actually, for the most part, especially if they get treated, they tend to have a pretty normal life expectancy. I have no clue why they love this on these exams, but they love to test it for some reason. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind, right? And again, I already talked about the eye problems they may have. They may have like the anterior uveitis. So notice I said anterior uveitis, not posterior. Anterior uveitis, right? So again, the slit lamp exam may be the next best step in diagnosis for these people, especially if they come in presenting with eye pain. Okay, again, I'm repeating it: anterior uveitis, not posterior. Posterior uveitis, if you see posterior uveitis on an exam, think sarcoid. Okay, there are many things that can cause posterior uveitis, but I'll tell you this: on an exam, if you see posterior uveitis, the only thing I really want you to think about is sarcoidosis. Okay, and again, I already talked about, again, how you see the bamboo spine on imaging. These people can actually get an interstitial lung disease, right? So like restrictive disease, where they will have like the normal or slightly increased FEV1 to FVC ratio, but they will have a reduced DLCO, right? That's what tells you that they're dealing with lung fibrosis. I mean, I don't know exactly how high yield this is, but the thing is, most rheumatologic diseases that cause interstitial lung disease, they tend to cause fibrosis of the base of the lung. Ankylosing spondylitis is kind of like its own thing. It actually tends to cause fibrosis of the apex of the lung. So that's like a relatively unique finding on exams with regards to ankylosing spondylitis associated interstitial lung disease. And again, remember, these people can have inflammation of their guts. And one other thing you may also want to keep in mind, right? So they can give you an exam question. It's like classic ankylosing spondylitis. And then they tell you that this patient has like a new murmur, right? They tell you that it's like, it's a holosystolic murmur that is, it's a diastolic murmur that is radiating all the way back to the left lower sternal border. If you see that, you really want to, especially if the pulse pressure is wide. So let's say they have like blood pressures of 150 over 50. Think about aortic regurg. Aortic regurg is actually relatively common in patients with ankylosing spondylitis. In fact, ankylosing spondylitis increases your risk for aortic dissection. Okay, so that's one of those weird, bizarre associations you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then, I mean, the IBD-associated arthritis, right? So that will classically present patient with like a history of like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, and then they have like many of the same findings as ankylosing spondylitis. That pretty much seals the deal for you on this test. So there's really not much I'm gonna say there. And the thing is, like I said, right, these people tend to have more axial involvement. Remember, I talked about this thing as a pair. I said that ankylosing spondylitis has many commonalities with IBD-associated arthritis. So most of the time, these people tend to have involvement of their axial skeleton, okay? Not necessarily their peripheral joints. But here's the kicker. Involvement of the axial skeleton has no correlation with disease activity in the gut for patients that have IBD-associated arthritis. However, if a patient has like peripheral joint involvement and they have like IBD-associated arthritis, the amount of peripheral joint involvement actually correlates with the amount of inflammation they have in their bowels. Okay, it's just one of those weird things. I don't foresee it being something that shows up on an exam, but it looks like something that a GI doc will feel very good, or a rheumatologist will feel very good about pimping you on. So I guess I'm just gonna go ahead and throw this in as a as an added bonus for you. So again, the level of axial involvement does not correlate with disease activity in the gut for IBD associated arthritis, but the level of peripheral joint involvement certainly plays a, like has a very strong correlation with the amount of inflammation in the gut. And then, like I said, I'll talk about the last two together, right? So like the psoriatic arthritis and the reactive arthritis, previously again known as Ryder syndrome, right? So the psoriatic arthritis, obviously they will have psoriasis, right? So they will have like these silver scale lesions on extensor surfaces, right? Nothing special there, right? But these people tend to have a lot of nail findings on these exams, right? So those are things you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So for example, they'll have like nail pitting, right? So literally like a pit, like a hole. They'll have like lots of little dots on their nail bed. They can actually give you a picture of that and sort of want you to identify that on an exam, right? And the thing is, they can have like these sausage digits, right? So literally their fingers look like sausages, right? They have a lot of like soft tissue swelling and all that crap. And then they can actually have separation of the nails from the nail bed, right? That the fancy medical term for that is onycholysis, right? I mean, that's why we go to med school. Instead of saying like your nail separating from your nail bed, we use the word onycholysis, right? So that that's like the medical term for nail separating from the nail bed. But anywho, so psoriasis and all these finger findings, think about a psoriatic arthritis. And then for the reactive arthritis, I mean, you probably remember this from your USMLE exams, like your step one, step two CK, it's like a triad, right? So like the can't see, can't pee, can't climb a tree, right? So so again, the triad is can't see, so because they have conjunctivitis, can't pee, because they have a urethritis, it tends to be a sterile urethritis, so you culture all you want, you're not going to grow any bugs, and then can't climb a tree, right, for the arthritis. Right, so this arthritis, like I said earlier, it tends to be an asymmetric arthritis, right? It tends to affect like very few joints. It doesn't usually affect many joints like you have in the neck, other seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? So it tends to affect very few joints, like one or two joints. And again, they have the conjunctivitis, they have like the sterile urethritis. So again, you're not going to find any bugs. And the thing is, this triad, right? I mean, again, I love the way they float these triads in internal medicine, even if most times they're actually pretty rare in the real world, right? So it's very rare to find a patient that literally has all three things going for them at the same time, right? And I mean, how does this classically present on an exam? It'll be a person that, like, usually like a young person, like recent GI or GU infection, right? So like they may have like a recent like bloody diarrhea from like Campylobacter or Shigella or Salmonella, or they may tell you a person that had like a recent like Yersinia infection, or it can be a person that recently had let's say like a sexually active young person with all these risky behaviors, right? So you're thinking like chlamydia under those circumstances. Those are like the classic presentations. And then they get into trouble. And then after like weeks afterwards, they say like, oh, doc, my knee hurts, right? If you see that, you really want to think about reactive arthritis. And again, these people, culture them up the wazoo. Usually, I'll say like almost always, you do not find any bugs. Okay, because basically it's not these bugs, it's not like a persistent infection that's causing your symptoms. It really is like your immune system reacting to the bugs that are causing these symptoms that you're going through. So I'll tell you this, you basically never want to give antibiotics for reactive arthritis on any of these exams. The only time you give antibiotics is if they clearly give you evidence of an ongoing infection, where you identified a bug. If you ID a bug, fine, give antibiotics. But I'll tell you this, I have very rarely, if maybe only once or twice, ever seen antibiotics be the correct answer in a question that dealt with reactive arthritis. So again, sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And then another thing you want to keep in mind with these reactive arthritis questions is they usually have one or two findings, right, on some part of their body, right? So they may describe like this person having like some kind of like a ring-shaped ulcers on the penis, right? Or they can like show you like a penis picture, and then you see these things that sort of look like shallow ulcers. They're kind of like round, right? So like ring-shaped ulcers on the penis. That finding is what is known as a succinate balanitis, right? So succinate, if I'm not mistaken, it's spelled as a C-I-R-C-I-N-A-T-E, right? So like circinatha balanitis, right? Because it's on the penis, right? So again, something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then the thing is, sometimes they may show you their extremities and you may see like these like splotchy lesions. Sometimes you can see them under the feet. That's the thing that's known as a keratoderma blenorrhagica, okay? Keratoderma blenorrhagica. I'll just encourage you, just sort of like look this up online. You'll see some pretty gross and nasty pictures. There's a reason why I did not go into derm in the first place. I love derm, love the material, but I just can't stand looking at those kinds of things. So how do you treat these seronegative spondyloarthropathies in general? The thing is, when you're thinking of treatment, right, because this is one very nice thing that your friends that write these exams try to confuse people with. Whenever you see a seronegative spondyloarthropathy, ask yourself, what is the part of the skeleton that is involved for the most part? Do they have a lot of axial involvement or do they have a lot of peripheral involvement? Because the manner of treatment is similar, but there are some key differences, right? So, for example, if they have their axial skeletons involved, right? So like their spine, their sacroiliac joints, the first thing you pretty much want to start with is an NSAID, right? And you also recommend physical therapy. So like NSAIDs, physical therapy. If your NSAIDs are not cutting it, your next line on the test is to consider a TNF inhibitor. Okay, is to consider a TNF inhibitor. Okay, so the next line is to consider a TNF inhibitor if they have axial involvement. If your TNF inhibitor does not work, then they probably won't go this far on an exam. But if your TNF inhibitor doesn't work, your next line are the more exotic immune-based therapies, right? So like you've probably heard of Stelara on TV, this drug known as ustekinumab. It's like more for people taking step 3. It's a monoclonal antibody against interleukin 17 and interleukin 23. Those work really well for the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, especially again if you have axial involvement. Another one you may see on an exam is something called a secukinumab. Secukinumab, I think it's called like Cosentyx. It's a monoclonal antibody against IL-17. Sorry, I misspoke. Ustekinumab is a monoclonal against IL-12 and 23. Secukinumab is a monoclonal antibody against IL-17. This is more for people that are taking step 3. I'd be surprised if you saw that on the medicine in training or the American, the ABIMR board exam. So, here's one thing that is super, super, super important. So pay attention here. You absolutely, positively do not want to use a DMARD for the treatment of axial lesions in the setting of a seronegative spondyloarthropathy, okay? If you pick a DMARD, that would be the wrong, I can pretty much guarantee you, that would be the wrong answer on a test, okay? They have done lots and lots and lots of studies, and they've shown that DMARDs do not work for axial involvement of the seronegative spondyloarthropathies. No one really knows why, or at least from my looking through the literature, there's no real reasoning, but that is the guideline. So you definitely want to keep that at the back of your mind. So please do not pick methotrexate as treatment for like axial, like primary, like axial involvement in a patient that has like ankylosing spondylitis, for example. But if these people have a lot of peripheral joint involvement, again, they won't be ambiguous on a test. They'll make it very clear, very obvious. Then, again, your first line, think of your NSAIDs, okay? Another thing you could potentially use as first line, I'll say for the most part, NSAIDs are correct, but you can actually use DMARDs here, okay? So this is where DMARDs come into play, like your methotrexate, your hydroxychloroquine, your sulfasalazine. These drugs work well for peripheral joint involvement in the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, okay? If your NSAIDs or your DMARDs fail, you can proceed to your TNF inhibitors. If your TNF inhibitors are not caught in it, then again, you can proceed to the exotic therapies I already talked about, right? So like your secukinumab, your ustekinumab, and stuff like that. So, again, you really, I know you may be like, oh, Divine, this is loyal. I promise you, I have taken these exams and I've tutored lots of people for these exams. These things are certainly not low yield. I'll tell you that right now. Okay. So, what if you get a question about a patient that they tell you that it's a 25-year-old guy. He tells you that, doc, let's say it's more like a 40-year-old guy, right? So, 40-year-old guy says, doc, I have like low back pain in the morning. I feel stiff. If I work out, things get better. And then you're like, it sounds like you have ankylosing spondylitis. And then you get imaging And then you notice that the sacroiliac joints are spick and span. So like no problems with the sacroiliac joints. If you see that, what are you thinking about? And then let's assume they show you imaging where you see like calcifications in front of the vertebral body. So like anteriorly, and you sort of see them across multiple vertebral body levels. What disease are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about this. This is a low yield concept, but it's one of those things that it's very easy to identify. They don't make the question hard because most people will get it wrong, right? But this person has something called diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, or DISH, okay? Or DISH. They love to test this on exams, really. But it's one of those things where like step three, you're like, you see, I'm like, I have no idea. Or even these board exams, you're like, I have no idea, okay? They love to test this every so often. So I'd definitely keep this at the back of your mind. Basically, they will give you a presentation of a person where you're like, oh, this is ankylosing spondylitis. But you get imaging, like plain film imaging. And you're like, this person's sacroiliac joints look good. Or they tell you that, oh, there is no evidence of sacroiliac joint inflammation or sclerosis or whatever. If you see that, then it is not ankylosing spondylitis. It is this diagnosis known as DISH. Okay, so the kicker is the absence of sacroiliitis. So it's like ankylosing spondylitis minus sacroiliitis equals DISH. Okay, so, and these patients, they tend to get most of their symptoms in the neck. So they'll say like, oh, they have like trouble moving their neck. And sometimes they may even tell you that, oh, on imaging, they find extensive ossification of the anterior longitudinal ligament. If you see that buzzword, pretty much stop reading the question and pick the answer that says DISH, okay? Or they may tell you that, oh, on imaging, they find like multiple bridging osteophytes. That's another buzz phrase, multiple bridging osteophytes. So essentially, these people have osteophytes that are joining multiple vertebral bodies. Again, if you see that, think about, that's why it's called bridging, because you're joining multiple vertebral bodies together. So this will have like spinal fusion. If you see that, think about a DISH. And these people tend to have like risk factors, right? Like most of their risk factors are like metabolic syndrome kind of risk factors. So like being obese, having diabetes and stuff like that. And really for the most part, these people, again, NSAIDs, physical therapy. Right, and sort of like treat their underlying metabolic issues. And this is actually, again, one of those weird disorders that have an association with atlantoaxial instability. You may say, Divine, you've repeated atlantoaxial instability so many times. Why do you think I'm repeating it? Do you think I'm repeating it because I love to like hear myself talk? Not really. I'm repeating it because they test this thing, like it shows up on pretty much every USMLE exam, a lot of these medicine board exams, and even the medicine in training exam. Okay, so before a person has surgery or you approve them to start sports, if they have a history of Down syndrome or rheumatoid arthritis or juvenile idiopathic arthritis or ankylosing spondylitis or DISH, so diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, you need to obtain cervical neck x-rays held in flexion and extension to rule out atlantoaxial instability. Again, you do not want to disengage the head from the spinal cord. No one ever comes back from that, right? So you don't want that. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about those arthritides. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 60-year-old guy, let's assume, you know, he loves his cold beer. He just had like met a few friends last night. They had like a few cold beers. They ate a lot of crabs, and let's assume like he has a history of hypertension and he takes like HCTZ for his hypertension. And then he comes to the hospital, comes to the ED and says, oh, doc, my leg hurts a ton, right? I mean, you probably know what I'm going after here. He says, my leg hurts a ton. It's my big toe. It hurts so bad. In fact, if air blows over my big toe, it just hurts like crazy, right? Like it's like almost like pregnancy-like pain. Although to be honest, I've treated patients with gout. I've also had a chance to be at like baby deliveries. I think I will say that gout pain feels nothing. At least just from being at a delivery and seeing a patient with gout, delivering a child is probably, if not one of the most painful experiences a person will ever experience in their lives. Thank God for anesthesia and epidurals. So when you see your mom or you see a lady that's pregnant and delivering a kid, you better respect them, right? Because that is certainly something I wouldn't, that is certainly something I would not want to go through myself. So be grateful. Be grateful for moms. They put in a lot of work. So just shout out to my mom, I guess. Okay, so back to this. So this person obviously has gout, right? And how does gout present? Again, acute onset, right? Super bad pain. And usually for some reason on these exams, they love to see that the pain started at night. Okay, that's like the classic presentation. The patient will be like in extreme pain. And again, it'll be monoarticular. So it will only be one joint that will be involved on your exams, especially like in the acute phase, right? So this person has gout, right? So this basically here, I'm going to be talking about the crystalline arthropathies, although I probably will only spend time on one today because there is a lot of high yield things that they love to test with gout. So I will go through all the high yield stuff. And then next, when I pick up these rheumatology series again, we'll go through the rest of the crystalline arthropathies, right? So what's the pathophysiology behind gout, right? You already know it's from the monosodium or urate crystals, right? So don't forget these boss phrases, right, that you probably learned for step one, step two. These people tend to have like the needle shaped negatively birefringent crystals, right? So if you see that buzzword, stop reading the question. It's gout, pretty much. Okay, and the thing is, you may say, okay, Divine, why does this hurt? The thing is, the reason gout hurts is, right, so one, you have the inflammation, but the thing is, these needle-shaped crystals basically like perforate neutrophils that come to like the site of inflammation. And when you perforate neutrophils, remember, neutrophils contain a lot of badness on the inside. So when you perforate them, they release all this badness into the joint, and then you have like massive, massive, massive inflammation. That's why you then have a really bad day if you're having a gout flare. And you may say, okay, so Divine, where do these monosodium urate crystals come from? The thing is, these monosodium urate crystals, they come from one of two processes. It's either you're making too much of them, right? So you're an overproducer, or you are not excreting these uric acid crystals as quickly as you should. So you're an under excreter. And the thing is, for the most part, most people that have gout are under excreters of uric acid, right? So pretty much like almost like 90, 92% of patients that have gout are under excreters. So you may ask, okay, so Divine, how can people overproduce uric acid crystals? I mean, there are many ways you can be an overproducer, but I'll say that usually, if you're taking these exams, they usually go after one of two people, right? They go after a person that is getting chemotherapeutic treatment for a lymphoma, right? Remember, those lymphomas, the chemotherapy tends to work like super awesomely. So a lot of cells die at once, right? And guess what? When a lot of cells die at once, what do you think they release into the circulation? DNA, right? And if you break down DNA, you can you ultimately basically get to uric acid, right? So if you're breaking down like your purines ultimately get broken down to uric acid. So that can be an example of overproduction as the etiology of a person's gouty attack. Another one that you'll probably more likely see on step three is if they describe a person that has like a Lesch-Nyhan syndrome, right? So remember, that's like a HGPRT deficiency. If I'm remembering correctly, I believe HGPRT is like the hypoxanthine guanine phosphoribosyltransferase. So those people have like a HGPRT deficiency. So their purine salvage pathway doesn't work. And if your purine salvage pathway doesn't work, well, you're going to have a lot of problems. Like you have problems like biting your, basically like chopping your fingers off. But in addition, they will also have gout because they cannot salvage purines. So they will have increased flux through xanthine oxidase to the production of uric acid. So those are the people that tend to be overproducers on exams, okay? But pretty much everyone else is an under excreter, right? And these people, I mean, they tend to have like risk factors on the exam, like they tend to have antecedents like having like the metabolic syndrome or drinking a ton of booze, right? So a lot of alcohol, being on a diuretic, right? So remember, like your diuretics, like your thiazides, your loop diuretics, they actually decrease the excretion of uric acid. So that can sort of put you in trouble or relatively really quickly. If you're also on like aspirin, right? So let's say it's a person that has like cardiovascular disease and they're on like low dose aspirin, so like your 81 milligrams every day, that actually increases your risk of gout as well, right? Because the thing is, low dose aspirin, so like the 81 milligram aspirin, that actually decreases the excretion of uric acid. But paradoxically, when you get to much higher doses of aspirin, that actually increases the excretion of uric acid. So pay attention to this. It is actually being on low dose aspirin that increases your risk of having hyperuricemia that can then predispose you to having gout, right? And then other things like red meat, right? That's another like classic risk factor on exams. And again, usually gout on exams shows up at the big toe, right? So like the first MTP of the big toe. And I mean, gout, what are some bad things that can happen down the line with gout, right? So the thing is, these monosodium urate crystals, they can build up over like years, right? And then if they build up, they form something known as a tophi, right? And the thing is, I mean, think about it, right? Sort of think of it this way. Let's assume you live in a one-bedroom apartment and it's just you, right? And let's say you're like a clean person, you love to keep your apartment clean, right? I'm kind of like that. So you want to keep your apartment clean, you don't want your apartment being dirty, everything is like spick and span the way you want it to be. And then let's assume you then begin to harbor, like you bring in like 10 other people to live in that apartment with you. Chances are that apartment is not going to stay clean. It's going to stay like dirty, going to stay destroyed or something, right? Things will not be where they should be, right? So that's kind of like the way that these tophi behave, right? They begin to build up around joints. And guess what they do? They destroy soft tissue. They destroy joints, okay? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. So tophi is something that you see in long-standing gout, So the way gout will, again, present, you'll present as a monoarticular arthritis, right? It'll be acute onset, right? And I mean, obviously, you don't have like some crystal ball to tell you that, oh, you know what? Maybe this is you don't have something that says, oh, this is definitely gout. I mean, it could be an infection. It could be a septic arthritis, right? So obviously, you want to get an arthrocentesis. So you tap that joint, right? And usually, if it's gout, you'll see like white blood cells in the tens of thousands. Okay, it can almost look like a septic arthritis picture, but you do the polarized light, whatever, you see the needle-shaped, like negatively birefringent and needle-shaped crystals, and you see a ton of neutrophils. Okay, so you see those things, you don't see any bugs, then you know you're dealing with gout. And the thing is, on imaging, right, in gout, right, like usually you'll see, like, especially if they have like tophi, you'll see like these like radiolucent sort of like punched out lesions in the involved joints. So you may say, but Divine, these are crystals and all that. Why are they radiolucent? Think about it, right? So go back to your studying for step one. What is the only kidney stone that is radiolucent? Those are your uric acid stones, right? So that should kind of make sense that, oh, like these tophi, which are, again, basically like conglomerates of uric acid crystals, they are radiolucent on imaging. You just see a lot of soft tissue swelling, but actually those things are a lot of like uric acid crystals that have been deposited. So how do we treat gout? The thing is, first things first, they will try to trick you on these exams and try to make you measure uric acid levels. Do not, especially like in the acute phase of gout, do not measure uric acid levels. Don't be tempted to pick that answer. If you pick that answer, you're going to get it wrong. Do not, like, resist that temptation. Just think of angry divine face telling you to not pick an answer that says to measure uric acid levels. That is almost always a bad idea on these exams. Now, so how do you treat an acute gout attack, right? So pretty much you start with NSAIDs, right? So indomethacin, ibuprofen, they work pretty well. Okay, another thing you could potentially use is steroids, right? So you can like inject steroids into the joint, especially if it's like one joint that is involved, or you can take like oral or like IV steroids. Those work pretty well. Again, if a person has a history of diabetes, chances are giving a steroid may not be the best idea in the world. If a person has a history of like peptic ulcer disease, or they have renal failure, maybe giving an NSAID is not the best idea in the world. Another thing you can also actually use acutely for gout is colchicine, but colchicine is like third line these days on these exams. So keep that at the back of your mind. And the thing is, your friends that write these tests, they love to give you multiple correct answers. They will give you like an NSAID, they'll give you a steroid, they will give you colchicine, and you're like, which one do I pick? If a person has like no risk factors, no contraindications, go ahead and pick NSAIDs. But the thing I will tell you that again is like the classic thing they do to people on exams. If they give you multiple correct answers, being a good test taker tells you that you should just basically look for some kind of contraindication. Okay, look for some kind of contraindication. So these people, right, the contraindication, for example, to an NSAID may be that, oh, they have renal failure, or they have like CHF. Or they have like a peptic ulcer disease. Then obviously for those people, you don't want to give an NSAID. You want to consider something else. So another, I guess, principle of treatment in the acute phase is, if the person is not on chronic like gout therapy already, in the acute phase, do not start gout. So let's say they've never been on allopurinol. Do not start allopurinol in the acute phase of gout. Or if they're already on allopurinol, do not stop the allopurinol, okay? Do not stop the allopurinol. Do not increase the dose. Don't change anything. Just keep things as is, okay? So do not increase or start like a chronic gout med in the acute phase of a gout attack, okay? So if they are not on allopurinol, don't start it. If they are already, keep their current dose, okay? Don't change anything, because if you make any change, that will increase the risk of worsening their flare or increase their risk of having more flares. So that's pretty much how you treat acute gout. So how do you treat chronic gout, right? So the way you treat chronic gout, like your poster child drugs are your xanthine oxidase inhibitors, right? Remember, xanthine oxidase converts, basically makes uric acid. So if you inhibit the enzyme, you no longer make uric acid, and then these people don't get into trouble, right? So what are your classic drugs here? Those are drugs like allopurinol, drugs like febuxostat, right, or febuxostat, whichever floats your boat. Remember, if you even look at the spelling, febuxostat, F-E-B-U-X-O-S-T-A-T. So XO tells you it's a xanthine oxidase inhibitor, okay? So those are like almost like your first line agents for chronic gout. And remember, these xanthine oxidase inhibitors, one super, super high yield thing you want to keep in mind is that they can have like some bad drug interactions with azathioprine. Remember, azathioprine, occasionally you may see it on exams referred to as a 6-mecarthopurine. Those drugs are broken down. One like metabolic pathway for those drugs is through xanthine oxidase. So if you give a xanthine oxidase inhibitor, you will stop metabolizing azathioprine to inactive byproducts. So your azathioprine will build up and you can get like a profound bone marrow suppression. So you want to be careful. You either want to like lower the azathioprine dose or stop the azathioprine dose, or maybe use a different drug, okay, so that you don't get into trouble here. So those are, again, the big things you want to keep in mind with your xanthine oxidase inhibitors, right? And the thing is, these drugs, I guess let me sort of take like a small detour here, right? So you're like, okay, Divine, how do we want to, like, what are we treating this gout to, right? So the thing is, usually you try to treat it to keep the uric acid levels like below like 6 mg/dL. So that's usually kind of like your target. If a person has like TOFA, your target is a little lower. Like you're trying to treat to like a target of like 5 mg/dL. So like a uric acid level that is less than 5 mg/dL. Now, what are some other drugs you can use to treat gout chronically, right? So you can use like this drug, probenecid, right? So probenecid is something that's known as a uricosuric agent, right? So probenecid increases your excretion of uric acid. But let me go ahead and tell you this right now. Probenecid is almost always the wrong answer on tests, because you literally need to meet many like super specific conditions to be able to give probenecid as treatment for gout. So what are some of those conditions? At least what are the ones that show up most commonly on an exam? First things first is the person has to be an under excreter of uric acid. That's the first thing. And then they also have to have like no renal failure. If they have renal failure, they cannot be on probenecid. Another thing is they must never have had like some kind of kidney stone, from gout, right? So they must never have had like nephrolithiasis. And then another weird one, right? So this one, they love to like slot it into questions, is if they have like tophi, or they've had like tophi in the past, then these people cannot be on probenecid. So basically, right, very few people, if any, prescribes probenecid in the real world, because again, there are like way too many conditions you have to meet. You cannot have renal failure, you cannot have had a tophus, you cannot have kidney stones. So I'll just tell you this is pretty much never the right answer on exams, but if you check all boxes, then you can go ahead with probenecid on a test. So pretty much, I'll say for the most part, you want to go ahead and avoid this answer like the plague on exams. I've seen it being correct like once or twice, but again, those are under like very specific situations where basically you check all these boxes I just mentioned. And then some other drugs you can use for a chronic treatment of gout. So these drugs are like super, super expensive, right? So like your uricase analogs, so drugs like pegloticase or asboricase. Basically, so they are called uricase analogs, right? So the thing is, birds, they actually have this enzyme known as uricase, because birds can go without water for a long, long, long period of time, right? So birds, because their urine is like super concentrated, birds don't want to get like stone problems. So they can convert this uric acid to something known as allantoin. So allantoin. So allantoin, it's water soluble, it's easily excreted. So the thing is, drug companies have devised uricase analogs, right? Like pegloticase or asboricase. They basically convert uric acid again to allantoin, something that is very soluble, so it's much easier to excrete. So these people, these drugs are like super effective. But with super effectiveness comes super cost. They are very, very expensive. Okay, so those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, if you notice, this thing is an analog of like almost like an animal product. So you can already begin to envisage the kinds of side effects that may pop up with these drugs, right? So these drugs, they cause a lot of, they can cause like some immune problems, right? So like people can have like anaphylactic reactions to these drugs, right? In fact, I'll tell you this. Usually, if a person is placed on these are uricase analogs, usually it's like IV therapy. You get like, I don't know how often, I think it's like once a week or once every 2 weeks or something like that. You want to track these people's uric acid levels, because if their uric acid levels are going down, then that's good. That means the drug is working. It's actively converting the uric acid to allantoin. But if a person is on pegloticase or asboricase and their uric acid levels are rising, that's an ominous sign. Because it means that the pegloticase, asboricase you're giving them is not having effect. And the reason it's not having effect is that the person has potentially made antibodies against it, right? And if a person is making antibodies against these uricase analogs, they potentially have anaphylaxis in their future. So when you see that, you want to go ahead and stop the infusion, stop the drug, so that you don't get into trouble. And another thing is, these drugs, so right, I said that, the uricase analog, so they help you convert uric acid to allantoin. The thing is, as you're going from uric acid to allantoin, it's kind of like a reduction reaction. So in the process, you actually make hydrogen peroxide as a byproduct. Well, is there a particular enzyme deficiency that makes it hard for you to handle hydrogen peroxide? Think back to your step one exam. So this is G6PD deficiency, right? So like a glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency. So on exams, if a patient, especially like the telltale sign of this on exam is like African-American person with gout that you want to start on these uricase analogs, you probably want to avoid them, okay? Or you want to test them for G6PD deficiency first before starting, okay? Because these drugs are, again, they are for the most part contraindicated in patients that have a G6PD deficiency. So the thing is, I mean, another common question is like, how do I know when to start this chronic gout therapy? Pretty much if you have more than one gout attack a year, right? That's pretty much a criteria. So if you have like two attacks in a year, you get started on these chronic gout therapies. Or if you have like complications of gout, so like you're already having like chronic kidney disease, or you're already having like nephrolithiasis, so like kidney stones, or you're already having like tophi, okay, under those circumstances, go ahead and start these people on a chronic gout therapy. And the thing is, when you start gout therapy, you actually, in addition to like giving the allopurinol, for example, you actually want to add like colchicine or like an NSAID alongside for like a couple of months actually after you start, so that they don't get flares in the intern. Okay, so you can start them on like colchicine at the same time or NSAID at the same time, or like low dose like oral steroids. Okay, you basically continue these agents for usually it's about like 6 months after you've kind of like hit your like target uric level, right? So like you're less than 6 mg/dL or less than 5 mg/dL if you have a tophi. So you continue for like a pretty long time, usually a couple of months, before you stop and then just keep them on the allopurinol. So I think that's where I'm going to stop. But I think before I round up, since we've been talking about like HLA-B something, HLA-B whatever, let me just mention some high yield ones that tend to pop up quite commonly on exams, right? So HLA-B27, right? You already know, if you see that, you're thinking about your seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? Is there a particular HIV drug that you need to test for a certain HLA before you start? I hope you're thinking about abacavir, okay? Before you start a person on abacavir, you better check for HLA-B57. Okay, because people that have HLA-B57, they are predisposed to having like a life-threatening hypersensitivity reaction to abacavir. Now, what's the HLA that's associated with Behçet's disease? That's HLA-B51. Okay, and then there's this one that's like super, super low yield, but it tends to affect mostly like Asians. But, and I mean, it's super rare, but it's something that may just pop up out of the blue on a test. If a person has like HLA-B58, if you want to be a little more specific, like HLA-B5801, these people are actually predisposed to having like a life-threatening hypersensitivity reaction to allopurinol. Okay, so for these people, it'll be an Asian on your test. So like an Asian sort of kind of keep, or like some like Korean person, like Korean or like Chinese, keep that at the back of your mind before starting allopurinol. But again, it's super rare. You may never see it in the real world like ever, but it's something that may show up on a test, okay? So definitely keep this at the back of your mind. And again, as I do whenever I round up, just want to throw it out there that I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? So like the USMLE Step 1 exam, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, Step 3, the medicine in training exam, the ABIM board exam. And you may say like, oh, Divine, but you're going into radiology. How do you tutor for the ABIM exam? If you're interested in the story behind that, just send me a message and I can give you some more details. And then also, if you have like an acquaintance that's in undergrad and needs tutoring for like organic chemistry, general chemistry, physics, biochemistry, physiology, histology, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one consulting for those things. Again, like application prep, interview prep, personal statements, mock interviews, stuff like that. Pretty much everyone I've worked with has matched. Most of them are their first choice. So take that for what you will. So I hope you find this podcast to be helpful. I know it was kind of long, but I promise you, this stuff I discussed today is super, super high yield for the three exams that I just mentioned. So I wish you a wonderful day. But to go off on a quick soapbox, I am glad that the Raptors are doing a great job. My main guy, Kawhi Leonard, is silencing Golden State. I just feel like Golden State, a little humility will probably go a long way with some of their players. So hopefully we seal the deal on Monday and the Raptors get their first NBA Finals championship. So I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful night, rest, sleep well, and God bless you. Thank you.